Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
All right, so let's dive in. I had to separate from Jeff just because some strep throat's been going around the office, not the COVID, but just another type of disease. And I'm pretty sure that I had it. So I'm on the antibiotics, but I want to make sure I do not get Jeff sick. So we are literally a couple offices down. I isolate myself and don't talk to anybody. The Minnesota flu. Hey there. Hey, Sherry, how you doing? Yeah, so anyway, so that's what decided to go around our office. So I forget who it was, but Patty was like, oh, your throat's sore last week. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of rough. She goes, well, strep's been going around. And I think that pretty much infected me right there. Just the thought of it. I think it planted the seed. And yeah, Jeff looks very cool. He looks like a man in black there. Tax Tuesday rules, ask live, Q&A feature in Zoom. The Q&A allows us to see your question and not get rid of it. Like, it won't go away. And I like the chat when you're just responding to things instantaneous or dealing with tech. So if you have a question, by all means, put it into the question and answer feature. And if I ask you for a response on something, maybe do a kind of non-scientific polling, then we'll do it in chat. If you have questions during the week or you want to ask something for our staff, by all means, send it to taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. We get hundreds every week. That's where we pick a few questions every week. I always grab kind of the shorter ones to do them live. Some of you guys are like, yeah, sure. No, you should see some of these things. It's a book, and Patty misspelled Anderson Advisors. So you may want to retry that again. Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors, not Advisros. You're going to make fun of Patty. If you need a detailed response, you'll need to become a Platinum or Tax client. By the way, we do have a couple of tax professionals on. Christos is on, and Elliot, and Impio. So you actually have some horsepower here on your questions. So this is the time to use it. If you want to ask a bunch of really good accountants good questions, then this would be the time. So lots of stock loss gain. Robert, how did you get lose money last year? The market was giving us the money. So we won't make fun of that. All right, so this is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. So the whole idea is to get good tax principles so you're able to start using some logic to get through some of the stuff that's out there. So here's the opening questions. Oh, and I'd even say, hi, Jeff. I've been talking to Jeff the last 10 minutes. So I'll say, how are you doing today, Jeff?
Jeff's doing good. Got my drink, got a few nuts left. We're good.
Jeff is living the vida loca. It's the calm before the storm of tax season, right? Never really ends here, but it gets intense at certain times. So the intensity. Looks like there's some trading questions, and somebody said, yeah, those are from 10 years ago. Okay, so it's not from this year. I was going to say, you should jump into our Infinity class if you've been having issues. We've been killing it. So it's not like we're a proprietary trading system. We're actually a really boring trading system that works. We don't really trade. We buy good value stocks that pay you money. We like that. All right, opening questions. Can you accelerate a large capital loss carry forward instead of just offsetting from capital gains every year? So we'll go through that. That sounds like it's probably, Robert, that may be your question. Could you go over when would it make sense for stock option traders to do the mark-to-market election? Can you go through an example? Absolutely. Is there any additional tax benefit besides the federal solar tax credit when you install solar on a rental property? And we'll go over that too. We own shares of a real estate farm syndication that will have K-1 passive income. It will have operating income, no rental income. So it sounds like they're actually working the property. If we have other real estate K-1 passive losses from rental property, can the K-1 income from the farm investment offset the rental loss from the other property? And I'll probably map that one out. We'll go over that. Can I convert my current single member LLC started at December of 2019 to an S-Corp for 2021 and have the tax benefits for 2021? I'm assuming you're asking about the tax benefits for the S-Corp. We'll go over that. If I start a 501c3, are there syndication deals that my 501c3 can invest into that are geared towards qualifying investments like facilities for care for the sick or veterans, or with disabilities? Or is it a requirement of the 501c3 to purchase its own complex and turn it into a facility to help a group like veterans or economically disadvantaged? Really good question. And we'll take care of it. If I have a single member LLC, when you see SM, that just means single member LLC, can I still get reimbursed for costs like vehicle mileage, or do I need to have an accountable plan in an LLC tax as an S corp? So we will absolutely go through those. I think we have a few more. There's always more, right, Jeff?
Always.
Our tuitions for professional learning deductible. What expenses, we'll answer that. What expenses are you able to write off in your first year of having an LLC, specifically expenses associated with establishing your business, ? I heard that you can turn your EIDL loan into a PPP loan and get it forgiven if under $150,000. Is there a procedure to do that? Can you help us with it? We'll go through that. And can my S corp pay me rent for my home office? And if so, is this considered personal income? So we have some pretty good questions today, and we'll zip into those. Right away, Jeff, what do you say about these large capital loss carry forwards?
I hope you have a better answer than me, because the only way you know to get rid of large capital loss carry forwards is to have capital gains to offset them. There is no way that I'm aware of to accelerate those.
So you have ordinary capital and passive. These are the types of income that you're dealing with. Not aware of any others. Let's see. So if I'm looking at things like rents, royalty, rents would be over here in passive, rental income. I'll just say rental because it's income or losses. Passive business interests. Those are the only two things that sit over in the passive side. Capital, you're going to have short term and long term. And ordinary is pretty much everything else, right? That's going to be your royalties. That's going to be your interest, profits, wages. Is there anything else I'm missing? Let's see, rent, royalties, dividends, interest, dividends.
The dividends can be either capital or ordinary.
Yeah, but dividends aren't going to be, you wouldn't have a loss on a dividend. So I'll just put dividend.
Okay.
They could be taxed as long-term capital gains. So it's this weird thing, but you don't have dividend loss. Is it possible to have dividend loss? Never heard of a dividend loss, but
no.
Anyway, so we have these three categories that you fall in. And what he's talking about is in either one of these categories, the gain offset is by loss. And then loss is stuck if it's passive. There's two exceptions, active participation and real estate professional. In capital gain, the gain is offset by loss. Loss offsets the gain and $3,000 of ordinary income. And I should say per year. Is that the right way to phrase it?
Yeah.
And then I'll get rid of this dividend thing and just say, because the dividend's always positive. And I'll just say that ordinary income is offset by ordinary loss, but ordinary loss offsets everything. So if you have capital gains, if you have passive income, your ordinary loss can wipe all those things out. And this is probably the biggest area of confusion that I see in accounting, because you'll have people that are making money in one of these categories. They'll have a loss in one of those categories, and they may not be able to use it. So we have a big loss over here. And unfortunately, your loss carry forward, you even lose that when you pass away. So you better live a really long time, because you're going to be using that $3,000 against your ordinary income unless you can get some capital gains. So you have a tax appetite, a capital gain tax appetite. And it doesn't matter whether it's short term or long term. You just need to make gain because you have a bunch of losses. And it always depends on how much loss you have as to how much it's really worth, because you're going to get gains here. It's like you could go conservative and maybe do syndications or things where the gain level is going to be small, but you're going to get the extra because you're not going to pay tax on. Is there anything else I'm missing there, Jeff?
No. I mean, the only way to really accelerate it is you got to sell stuff that has a large unrecognized capital gain in it. It might be a rental property. Your home could be a candidate, but that's got the large exclusion already built into it. You may have stock positions that have grown over the years that you've just never left or never done anything with. So it's just a matter of finding where you can generate that capital gain to offset those capital losses. if you got large capital losses, that's free money if you sell a stock that's got substantial gains to it.
And if somebody's actually talking about the depreciation, like they're starting to realize, wait a second, so it's over here. So passive gain or income, I should say, is really, because it's not really gain, because it's not a capital sale. So it's active income is offset by passive loss. So if you have a syndication that creates a big fat loss and you have other rental income or passive business income, these are businesses in which you do not materially participate. So it's usually I put money into a business that I don't do anything for, then yes, you could use it against that as long as it's passive income. So you end up with a tax appetite of capital. Let's say that I have something where I'm generating large passive losses every year. I own buildings, I own big swaths of real estate. You now have a tax appetite to go into syndications and be a passive owner. And it's kind of weird when you start realizing, you watch the wealthy and you say, why are they investing in that? They would want control, because quite often they have a tax appetite. So they're willing to take less on something because they won't be paying tax on it. Hope that makes sense.
One thing you mentioned, Toby, was when we talked about the dividends, that is a decent way to help reduce that capital loss, because most dividends, except for like real estate investment trusts, are considered capital income.
I'll put qualified in.
Qualified dividends. Correct. So the real estate investment trust is not a qualified dividend, but many of your standard corporations are.
Yeah. So Johnson & Johnson, 3M, Lowe's, Federal Realty. Well, no, I guess Federal Realty Trust wouldn't be, but.
I think this is one thing you talk about in Infinity too, that if you have a good dividend paying stock, it may not be growing much in value, but it could be generating a nice income stream that's not going to be taxed because of your capital losses.
Patty, it's okay if they ask the questions relating to what we're hitting on right now. Patty's always going to tell you guys, put it in the Q&A. But what is a capital loss? Is an example of depreciating the value of a building? No. It's if you sell the building at a loss. So you actually lose money on it. Or if I sell stock at a loss, that's going to be capital loss. If you sell a house, you don't get any, that's personal property. You get no loss from personal property. So if you sell a car, you sell your house or something at a loss, it doesn't help you any. So it gets kind of funky. This is why you have an accountant. This is like completely self-grand, promoting, but this is why you have platinum, guys, is because you could put a question like this, hey, I'm about to do X, what are the tax ramifications? And we would look at it and say, oh, you've been holding, let's say you have capital gain. It's going to be short-term, and you heard short-term capital gains really bad because it's going to be taxed as ordinary income. But then we see that there's capital losses. That's one of the first things they're going to ask you is, well, do you have capital loss? You might say, yeah, but it was from long term. Perfect. Use it against your short term gain. It doesn't have to be the same. It just has to be capital gain and loss. And then you'll be like, wait a second. I mean, I can use something that I've been sitting on for years, afraid to take the loss, and it will offset my short term capital gains off of some option trading I did. Yes, exactly what you do. And so it's just, asking the right, sometimes it's just getting clarifying answers and asking the right question will help you out. And then with the passive side, it's the same thing. It's once you realize that you have a tax appetite somewhere, then you can go into the right type of income, just like Jeff was saying. If I have a bunch of capital loss carry forward, maybe I should be doing dividend investing like crazy. Maybe I want to have capital gains. Maybe I want to sell option and get option premium because I won't pay any tax on it. And it gives me an appetite and tells me exactly what type of income I want. So I forget the name of the gentleman that had the capital losses, but that's Jeff's recipe right there. Qualified dividends, selling option on your stock portfolio. Maybe it's even doing covered put where you're selling put on something that you would buy just to take the premium, and you have enough cash to cover it if you were the stock was put to you, but you have an appetite. And then somebody says, does being designated as a real estate professional impact all this? Only over here and only with regards to loss. If you have excess passive loss, the two exceptions to that having to be used against passive income are if I'm an active participant in real estate and I make less than $150,000, or I'm a real estate professional, in which case those losses become ordinary. Kind of weird. Or in the stock market, if I don't want my capital losses to be treated as capital loss, I have to qualify as a trader, in which case I would not only have to qualify as a trader, but then I would have to make a mark-to-market election. And then my losses and my income are considered ordinary. What happens is I move over into this category. So over here, you also have traders, and I tend to just freak out when I see traders because it's not supposed to be there. It's not really there. It's something made up that people are putting over there. And then the IRS always says, should you be over here? You know, should you be in this section? And then they give you the once over. And I try to avoid that. At this pace, Jeff, we will be here until midnight. That was a good question. Could you go over when it would make sense for stock option traders to do the mark-to-market election? And could you go through an example?
You know my opinion. I've seen so many cases where people claim trader status and made the mark-to-market election. And the courts are notorious for saying, nope, you don't qualify, nope, you don't qualify, etc. It's very onerous rules to be a trader.
And I agree with you 100%. If you're going to be a trader, you're going to have to be doing, I would say, 750 plus trades per year with no time off and with no real W-2 income. Like, it has to be what you do. Then you get business that you're treated as a business and you get to write off expenses. Traders have the option to do what's called, something called a mark-to-market election. It's what, 475?
I believe so.
And you have to do it at the beginning of the year. So like, you have to do it before April 15th of every year. So if you were a trader and you wanted to make a mark-to-market election, you'd have to do it sooner than later. But what it does is it makes all gain is now ordinary income. In other words, there's no gain anymore. And losses equal ordinary losses, which can be used against any other form of income. So you get to write off your losses. So you'll see accountants that are, you know, trader specialist accountants always talking about losses. That's how they sell the clients and doing the MTM. They're like, hey, if we do this, not only do you get your expenses, but you can write it off against your other income when you lose money. And I always say, well, why are you losing money? Well, we're trading in the stock market. I'm like, all right. Traders tend to lose lots of money in the market. My experience, people that trade aggressively and aren't coming at it from a different philosophical standpoint. A lot of people are just chasing, like, this year was probably a good year to be a trader. Most years are bad years to be a trader, and they lose big time.
And going back to that 750 trades, one of the rules for being a trader is those trades have to be going after the very short-term change in price. In other words, you're not looking at growth or investment. You're looking at beating the market daily.
Yeah. And a lot of times, like, traders will say you're out of your trade by the end of the day. You don't carry overnight positions. It's not that. But we don't. The problem is it's something that you go to court and you say it's facts and circumstances. So you're going to present your case to a judge. It's not something that you get to say, here's the hard and fast rule. It doesn't exist. So mark to market, that's the question. And when would it make sense? It really only makes sense to me if you're going to lose lots of money. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to me. And I always, and it's frustrating because I actually saw this happen when the stock market goes up and then down. And let's say that it goes down. This is bad. This is a January. Let's say this is January 1st. You are taxed if you do mark to market. You are taxed as though liquidated.
Meaning they treat you like you closed out all your positions.
They treat it as though you sold it all. So you're going to have all this gain as ordinary income on December 31st, even though you didn't sell it. And then here we are, and this is probably, I'll go like this and say, oops, then you pass down. And let's say this is April 15th. You owe your taxes on all of this gain, but you didn't sell anything. And so Qualcomm is the example I always give, because Qualcomm had a whole bunch of clients doing the Qualcomm thing in the late 90s, and it ran up some ridiculous amount. It did like a Tesla, just ran way up and then gave it all back the following year. And if you had sold, you'd be paying most of it to tax. Like, you were forced to be in a position where you had to pay the tax bill regardless of whether you sold it. And even if you liquidated your portfolio, there really wasn't anything left over after paying the taxes for a lot of those folks. And I was like, why would you do that to yourself? Doesn't make a lot of sense. So we tend to focus more on making sure that we have a partnership of some sort with a corporation, and it could be an LLC tax as a corporation. But I want a 1065, which is usually it's going to be an LLC or limited partnership. Probably an LLC. I'll just take that out. I'll just say LLC so I don't confuse people. And that corporation, more than likely, is going to be about a 20% partner, and it's going to be the manager. and it's going to make money, and it's going to use that money that it generates to cover expenses and things like that. And then when the money, when your 80% flows out, it keeps its same status. It's capital gain. We don't play around. We're not trying to qualify you as a trader. We're saying, hey, it's a managed portfolio. You have a guaranteed payment to partner. If you want to say, hey, we're going to pay the corporation $10,000 a year, whatever it is, a decent sized account, that'll come off. Or it's just, you're just paying it as profit. And that way you're not looking to deduct anything. You're just allocating the profit. Somebody says, why the LLC versus the limited partnership? Jeff, you can knock that one if you want. I mean, if you're just doing a percentage, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, the LLC, I think we have a little more flexibility with, especially since we're paying the corporation who is one of the partners slash members of this 1065. It makes it a little easier to pay that management fee or that guaranteed payment to the corporation. It also allows the other member, the individual that owns 80%, allows them to deduct their share of those ordinary losses created by that management fee and any other business expenses.
See, we don't want it coming down onto your personal return because you will not be able to take management deductions any longer since the Tax Cut and Jobs Act did away with miscellaneous itemized deductions. So I suppose you could do either. Like, we can get to the same place with either, but I prefer not to sit there and dink around. Somebody's asking about the corporation and managing this. You always make sure that it's conducting multiple businesses. So there is the question as to whether the corporation would have to qualify as a trader. A management company never has to sit there and qualify. If it's just managing a singular portfolio, you may be looking at an issue. I've never actually seen it go into a court, but could they, under some tortured interpretation of the law, try to make you qualify? Yeah, but we combat that by saying, hey, it's going to manage real estate. It's also going to be part of an estate plan. We do all these things. We could always, if somebody says, what about an LP to an LLC? You don't necessarily have to convert it. You can, but we would look at it and just make sure it's giving you, under your circumstances, the optimal treatment. Let's jump on. Somebody asked about futures and whether it's still 60-40. Yes, our adage is first do no harm. So we don't want to change the nature of the income. So if you have futures, it's treated as 60% long-term capital gain, 40% short-term, whether you held it for a day or a year and a day. Somebody says, can the managing corporation deduct 20% of the qualified business expense? You could actually do 100% of any business expenses for managing, and it can deduct it out of its portion of the profit. Somebody says, could you be a trader and a real estate professional? They're different. So you can. It'd be really tough because the real estate professional requires that you're spending more than 50% of your personal time qualifying. So it would have to be a spouse. And then, yes, you could still qualify. It's like you could be a full-time surgeon and still qualify as a real estate professional because you don't have to do the first part. It could be a spouse. And then you both materially participate. So you could literally be sitting back spending 100 hours a week on something and your tax return could still say real estate professional. Is there any additional tax benefit besides the federal solar tax credit when you install the solar on a rental property?
There is a benefit. The current credit is 26%. Is that correct? Or did it drop again in 2021?
Well, 2020, it was 26. It was supposed to drop. Then the last tax act at the end of the year, I forget what they called it, the last one that they did with all the stimulus checks that included an extension for 2 years, the solar tax credit at 26% for 2021 and 2022.
So let's say it was still 26% for solar panels put in 2020. So you get your 26% credit. Since it's a rental property, you'd also be able to depreciate 87% of your total cost of that solar installation and depreciate that over what life are we using? The short-term life, the five-year life, I believe?
It's 5 year, but you could accelerate. You could choose to bonus depreciate.
So we could bonus depreciate that.
Yeah, so it's you take one half of the, so you say 86%?
I said 87%.
87, oh, let's
see. So 26%, 26. You get half of a...
Half of it, so 26, what's half of 26? That's horrible. 13. I can't even do the math. Well, no, it's not 13. It is 13. Gosh, I don't know why it's like it's throwing me off the basic math today. Yeah, 26 divided by 2 is 13, so 87%. And it's a different section. So you're going to see people say you can't do it. It's section 48, and 38. Those are the two operable sections for businesses. It's not your, it's not the same tax credit that you do on your personal home. It's for a business. And somebody says, please explain. All right. So let's say I have a rental house and I put solar on the rental house, not me renting it, that I'm renting it to tenants. So let's say that Jeff owns rental house in Indy. We'll put you in Indy. And the house is worth 60K and you put $20,000 solar on it and you're going to provide the electricity now to the tenant. Tenant's going to pay you for the electricity. You would get, first off, level number one, first benefit, number one, is equal to a 26% tax credit. This is not a deduction. This is a credit. So what would 26% of 20,000 be? That would be what, 5,200?
Yep.
So yeah, 5,200 credit. That's just like dollar bills in your pocket. So if your tax bill is 5,200 and you have a $5,200 credit, you pay zero. Number two, and this is the cost of installation and the materials. So number two is you get to write off 87% of the basis. And so that would be, would that include the installation and everything, Jeff?
Yes.
You add everything into the basis. And so now we have, what would that be? 17,400 or what is it?
Correct.
17,000. Yeah. So then you would get 17,400 deduction. And if you're wondering how I got to the 17,400, it's because we took half of this 5,200. So we'd take, what is that, 2,600?
Yes.
And we subtract that off. And this is the amount you can depreciate. So then we would get also a 17,400 deduction. And if renters in an LLC, can it come down to your personal return? Absolutely. Now, here's what's cool. You may have had to come out of pocket no dollars to get solar on your house nowadays. You may be paying that off over a period of years. So in year one, you're going to get a big tax credit and you're going to get a big deduction, but you may be paying it off over, you know, 5 years too. You know, so there's some benefit there. And then it says, would it also include the net operating income from the lower electricity bill? Yes. You're now starting to make income off of your investment of $20,000. You're going to be getting an income source in addition to the tax. So it makes it much tastier if people understand how to do that. Where we're really seeing that is in Hawaii, where a lot of housing is starting to go kind of off grid. Somebody says, does the credit apply to primary residents? Yeah, the 26% is a different code section, but it'll apply to your house too. You can get a 26% tax credit. You don't get any depreciation because it's not a business asset.
But on a rental property, this $20,000 investment sounds like a lot of money, but I'm calculating the first year of tax saving for most people is going to be about $9,000.
Yep. Again, we've been talking about this for a few years. I haven't pulled the trigger on a lot of rentals, a lot of solar, because for whatever reason, it always seems like with the utilities, they play games. So they did green credits here in Nevada. One second you could do things and they said no, then now you can. You hate playing games. You got to have some certainty. I think we'll have some certainty, especially under the new administration, whether you like them or not. This administration seems very geared towards alternative energy, and then you just want to keep your eye on. It may be something that you're able to get a nice benefit on. Can the business rent to an owner of the business? Yeah, there's no problem with that. It's arm's length. So if you have a business that's in the rental and you're actually renting it, then it's investment property, then absolutely. All right, more fun stuff. And by the way, we do have groups that actually do this with nonprofits. They put it on their church. They'll rent it to their church. They'll have an agreement or whatever organization you care about. There were some water utilities that were putting these things out for people to put the property on so they could get the tax deduction on it, and they're instead of just depreciating it, they're usually trying to get a tax deduction. When does the credit become effective? As soon as you put the material, I think it's 10% completion.
Yeah.
And once you know that, that's the year that it becomes where you get the benefit. We own shares, and I'll let you do this one, Jeff. I'm being bad. I'm hobarting. We own shares of a real estate farm syndication that will have K-1 passive income. It will have operating income and no rental income. If we have other real estate K-1 passive losses from rental property, can the K-1 income from the farm investment offset the rental loss from the other property?
And what's really important to remember here is it doesn't matter if it's rental income or ordinary income. What matters is passive income offsets passive losses, regardless of the source, as long as it would normally, yeah. So in this case, the ordinary income from operating the farm is going to be offset or can offset any of the rental losses that you may have coming from elsewhere. I'm always interested to see what Toby's writing.
I'm just writing what you're saying.
Okay.
It's exactly right. So I drew up the three categories earlier. It's kind of funny that it's playing itself out throughout this. I didn't really intend to, but just because you have ordinary income doesn't mean that it's not from another source. So short-term capital gains, for example, are taxed as ordinary income. But capital gain versus capital losses, they're in their own little basket. Mm-hmm. So you may have passive income that is taxed as ordinary, but it's still passive. And passive losses offset passive income. So if you have passive operating income from a farm and you're not materially participating, then that is passive. And if you have passive losses from real estate, rental real estate activity, that is passive and they offset each other. So then you could take, hey, I made a whole bunch of money from my farm and I had a whole bunch of loss that I generated from, you know, a syndication I was in or other, I totally had that off and I turned it back on when you were playing with yours. whoops. So anyway, so it ends up offsetting each other. Ends up being pretty cool. Good job, Jeff. But you answer so quick and I just blah, blah, blah on.
Little to say.
I think our guys are really hammering away on these. I'm trying to think. They've already answered 41 and there's about 18 open. Here's an easy one. Is depreciation recapture subject to the net investment income tax?
I want to say that it's not. That's a good question that I really haven't ran across before.
I thought you would know that just off the top of your head. I was like, oh, it's an easy one. I'll throw Jeff a softball.
And it hit me right between the eyes. Yeah, because the capital gains would be, and the depreciation recapture is more or less a reclassification of some of those capital gains. So I'm going both ways now.
I just like watching you squirm a little bit. Hey, Elliot or Pio or Christos, do any of you guys know? Put it in chat if you do. This is why we have the brain trust. Is depreciation recapture subject to, don't worry, you're not going to see the question to the man. I'm reading it off of the Q&A feature. It's something somebody's asking. And yeah, we don't put the questions up because it has their names on it. So Pio or Elliot or Christos, let's see if any of these guys know. Does depreciation recapture, is it subject to the net investment income tax? And Jeff, you could probably look it up in 2 seconds.
I'm doing that.
I know. It's kind of funny. You're sitting here and you're doing returns all the time. You're like, you see too many. Yeah, I'm not seeing our brain trust is doing something else. They're not listening to you, Jeff, or me. All right, let's move on. Hey, real quick, while you're doing that, Jeff, I'm going to tell these guys. January 30th, we have a tax and asset protection workshop. It's a one-day event. We're doing them virtual. We used to do them 3 days live, but since we still have the plague going around out there, we are making sure that we do not subject anybody to unnecessary risk. So let's do these things virtually. Clint and I are teaching this one. We don't get to teach together a lot, but this is one where Clint and I definitely are going to be teaching on the 30th of January. So if you want to come to a day, I will share with you the link. It's free. ABA.link or ABA.link/ and then TAP, Tax and Asset Protection 30. I'm still waiting on a question. Somebody says tax and asset protection class is awesome. It's a lot of fun too. Anyway, did you see whether it's subject to the net?
Not exactly, but I'm leaning towards that it is going to be subject to net.
All right, we'll look at it. Christos is digging on it. All right, let's get into more fun stuff. We're going to say that you stumped the class on that one. We'll get back to you. It's not something I want to guess on. Can I convert my current single-member LLC started in 12/19 to an S-Corp for 2021 and have the tax benefits for 2021?
Absolutely. That's fairly easy to do. It's a form called Form 2553. It's your S election. The only stipulation I'm going to give you is it needs to be done by March 15th of 2021 to be effective as of January 1st, 2021.
Okay. Now, could they potentially go back and do 2020 Would there ever be a circumstance where they make a late election?
There is circumstances where they can make a late election. I don't want to say it's a guaranteed late election. They do approve most of them, but I've seen a number that they just, for whatever reason, decided not to.
Do you have to have an excuse? Like, hey,
yes, absolutely.
Is bad accountant advice an excuse?
Sometimes. Reliance upon a professional can be an excuse.
All right. So sometimes you can go back. What you can definitely do, as long as the election is it's a 2553 election. And when you go from a disregarded LLC, which is what a single member LLC is, to the and make a 2553, that's all you have to do. You don't have to do, what's the other one, the 8332?
Correct. The check, what they call the check the box form.
Yeah. So you can go back. And then, yes, you get the tax elections. And somebody says, what if I started my LLC in 2012? Can I still do the S election?
Yeah. Can, right. As long as you're electing for a current year, you can actually, what Toby was talking about, you could actually go back, I think, up to 3 years with a late election. But the further back you want to go, the less likely they're going to approve.
What about the penalties that might be incurred if you made a late election? You said, hey, I should have had this election. Do they penalize you for a late filing?
I believe they do. So if you wanted to go back and say my 17 and 18 and 19 returns all should have been S corporations, they're going to subject you to a penalty. But I think that's a case where you need your tax professional to write a letter for a reasonable cause that we didn't know at the time. There was a mishap or something that kept you from being an S corp timely electing.
Yeah, there's no penalty if you change it for this year. So Chris, they're wrong on that one. So you can change to an S. I'm assuming that you haven't revoked an S election within the last 5 years. Right. So you still have to qualify for S, which means it's an individual natural person owning it. It's possible to do it through a disregarded LLC that owns it, possibly a living trust, but like
no foreign owners.
Not unless they're a resident, it just have to be a grandparent or here. So you have to qualify for the S, but then if you make it, it's forward looking. So there's no penalties, and it's not an issue if you start this year. That's right. So Chris, you're good. Even for changing this year, correct. So yeah, there's no penalty for late because there's no return due on it yet. So the question is, what if I changed last year and said, I should have done it for 2020, and you did it now? You're not even late on 2020 yet. For 2019, you'd be late, and then you'd have penalties of what? How much is it per shareholder?
I believe it's $205 per shareholder per month, up to a max of 12 months.
Yeah. And then the date is the 15th day of the third month following the end of the tax year. Right? So March 15th.
And that date is also important. Say you did convert your LLC for 2020. You need to either get your tax S corp tax return done by March 15th, or at least get an extension.
So we'll just give you a big old yes on that one, and then all the other questions. Somebody says, Christo says the entire gain from the sale will be subject to net. There is no additional net on the depreciation recapture. So the gain on sale will be subject to net investment income tax, but there's no net on the depreciation recapture. So Christo's, I just want to confirm that. So just the gain would be taxable. And then if you do a 1031 exchange, I imagine you could avoid it. If you had a bunch of capital gain loss carry forward, you could avoid it. So the depreciation recapture is subject to net investment income tax. Just verify that that's true, if it just by itself. So there's always two components. Correct. All right. Thank you. So no worry about that. Glad we didn't guess. That's why you keep accountants on the line. If I start a 501c3, it means I can actually mark that question off as the way I answer it too. And otherwise, it'll just be sitting there staring at me for the next 3 minutes. Maybe I already marked it off. Somebody says, what's the cost? I would just reach out. Like, those are really easy, David. If you're platinum, we'd probably just do it for you. If I start a 501c3, are there syndication deals that my 501c3 can invest into that are geared towards qualifying investments like facilities for care for the sick, veterans with disabilities? Or is it a requirement of the 501c3 to purchase its own complex and turn it into a facility to help a group like veterans or economically disadvantaged? Mr. Webb.
We talked about this somewhat, about being an accredited investor and then some of the syndications where you do not have to be an accredited investor. But I think part of my problem with this is if you're just investing in a syndication to fulfill the purpose of your 501c3, I'm not sure you're actually fulfilling the purpose of the 501c3.
Right. So first thing to always understand is that 501c3s, generally, when they're getting approved, they're specifying what it is that they're doing. So if you're doing a deal, like if you're going into the working and providing housing for the disadvantaged, and you have a very open definition, it could be low to moderate income housing, it could be veterans, it could be single moms, it could be any group that is disadvantaged, then it would qualify. And let's say you had the approval, then anything you do in that space that's furthering your purpose is going to be fine. Any investment you get into is also fine. Like 501c3s can do investments. The question is, after what we do here is we do a 5-year advanced approval process. So we get what's called an advanced ruling on your 501c3 status as a public charity, meaning that it doesn't have to do anything to qualify as a public charity. It's qualified based off of its plan. You don't have to worry. You're actually good. It helps. And, you know, the reason that we look at this is there are some safe harbors that are written in some of the from the Treasury as far as advisory opinions. Like, this is what we say is a safe harbor. 60% of your income, I think maybe as high as 70%, coming from low to moderate income housing. That means that you automatically qualify going forward. I've never seen somebody denied. Like, when somebody goes and says, hey, I want to help people, it's not an issue. Just the safe harbor is, no matter what I do, they absolutely can't mess with me. But if you're doing things for groups, like you're just mentioning, you're going to be absolutely fine. Everything here, this is like a big old yes, you could absolutely do it. Jeff is pointing out that if you're in a syndication, a lot of them are only for accredited investors, which means that the organization would have to have over $5 million, or it would have to be in an investment where they allow non-accredited investors. That's the only thing. I've never really seen them. Actually, I could say I've never seen them question organizations that are doing this type of work that are actually doing this type of work. So I don't think there's any. Somebody just asked a very simple question that I thought I'd throw up there, which is, what if your rental burns down and you get insurance? They're replacing, you generally it's a replacement value and there's no tax ramifications, but what you're not allowed to do is get like rent loss rents, get money for it and not declare that as income. So again, I don't think there's big. I had a rental property burn down. All they do is give you a check so you can fix it up, and it's just going to go into basis, so it's neutral. You're just going to write it off again. You're going to depreciate it. So just remember that whenever you have a rental property, the structure itself is what you're depreciating over time. It's 27 and a half years unless you break it into its components through a cost seg, but you're depreciating it over time. So if you have something that gets destroyed and then you put it right back into service, you're just re-depreciating. I suppose that if you had something burned down, you could say, hey, I'm retiring the whole roof and take a whole bunch of depreciation and then write it off the new part again. If you retired, like, again, if your whole house burned down, you may get a little tax benefit there.
Yeah, the only time I've ever seen issues is when a property was overinsured. Mm-hmm. And that's not only a tax issue, that's an insurance issue also, where you're receiving more money than the property was actually worth.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I would say to you, Annie, is send us over your situation so we can look at it and just see what you're getting compensated for. Because like missed rents, definitely. If they're fixing something and it's a repair, then I would say probably no. Insurance proceeds tend to be non-taxable. It always depends on what they're for, though. Hey, you could always follow us on social media. By all means, jump into any of those and you could jump in and you could follow us. We do put a lot of material out there. And from what you guys are asking, some of you guys may actually benefit. Somebody says, what software program are you using? It's right on the screen. I use, Surface Studio. So I have a big screen that I can draw on, or I use Surface Pro. Today I'm using the Surface Studio. And it's just regular old PowerPoint with a little pen. That's why I like, a lot of people are Mac fanatics, and I tend to be more on the PC side just because this allows me to draw whenever I want, so I can, you know, so I can draw all over the place that I like to draw. So, voila.
And I'm still using DOS. So
you're still using an abacus. Some of you guys, I see him in there, and he's like moving beads across the the big stick. I'm like, Jeff, you should go move up to a calculator. I'll even spring for it. If you have a single member LLC, can I still get reimbursed for costs like mileage, et cetera? Or do I need to have an accountable plan in an LLC like an S-Corp?
And with the single member LLCs, you can certainly reimburse your costs like the vehicle mileage. And you mentioned accountable plan. You got to remember that when you're reimbursing for vehicle mileage, you're actually keeping track of your mileage, which automatically makes that an accountable plan. An accountable plan is just you're saying that you're accounting for the costs that you're reimbursing. A non-accountable plan would be like you may have a traveling salesman that you just throw $1,500 a month at them for auto expenses and don't expect them to report back what they spent it on. And that would be a non-accountable plan that has totally different ramifications. Anything you want to add?
No, when you have an accountable plan, I tend to think of that as employer.
Right.
When you have an item like a rental property, for example, you have a single member and you have expenses directly associated with that property, then it's really not, you're not reimbursing an employee anymore. You're just taking a direct expense. And so it's just subtle difference, but it makes a big difference depending on the type of activity you're doing.
No, you're right. This would be more of a direct expense of the LLC.
So it's not that it's handing, like in this particular case, it's not really handing you the money. You're getting the rental money, but it's taking a deduction. In the case of an accountable plan, think of you working for Microsoft and you incurring expenses that you turn into Microsoft and it hands you money, and then Microsoft writes it off. What you're not having here is the reimbursement. So it's just writing it off, but it's your money, and like there's no difference between you and the entity. You have to put accountable plan language only if you are doing, so in an LLC, you have accountable plan language if you are an S-Corp or a C-Corp for tax purposes. Otherwise, it just says that it's allowed to incur expenses and can pay those. And so there's no difference between you and the entity when you're a single member. It's just you. So you're already incurring the expense for the mileage. You're not getting reimbursed. You're just writing it off on your tax return. It's a subtle difference, but it makes a big difference depending on what you're doing. Our tuitions for professional learning deductible. So I don't pick, like, I don't write these guys, and so don't make fun of the tuitions, but I kind of like it. So tuitions for professional learning deductible. I guess it's plural. I guess you could say it is.
I'm not looking that up. And we haven't said this yet today, so I'll say it now. It depends. So if you're in a business where you have professional learning, you can deduct it in that business. If you're talking more along the lines of deducting professional learning as a tuition expense or a tuition credit, it's not eligible for that. So about the only place I can think of to deduct it is within a business at this point. Or get your employer to reimburse it.
Yeah, so let's just say, I think Jeff is always so literal. So I always look at this and I immediately start thinking, hey, can I deduct it in my business? And Jeff's way smarter than I am because he immediately goes and says, this may be an individual asking this. So if I'm writing off, like if I go get an MBA or things like that, I can't write off. That's not a deductible expense. If I go get a PhD, JD, even a CPA, it's not a deductible expense to me individually. I may get learning credit. I may get some deductions on interest. There's things like that, but it's not deductible. Now, if my employer sends me to improve my skill as an employee, or if it's part of my licensing. So like Jeff is a CPA, he has to go to continuing education. I'm an attorney, I have to go to continuing education. All of those are deductible. All of my expenses for continuing education would be deductible. If Boeing, I'll use a real life example because my mentor, Jerry, super, super cool guy, passed away a few years back, but I like just what a great guy. He went to school, MBA, was working with Boeing. Boeing's paying for the MBA. He's sitting next to students that don't work for Boeing. Boeing can reimburse him for his tuition because it's making him a better employee. None of those other students can write off their MBA because they're not an employee. They're preparing themselves for a new skill for a new profession. So hopefully that somewhat makes sense. So you do have to have a business if you want it to be deductible. And gone are the days when, even if you didn't have a business, you can't write it off as an unreimbursed business expense, because gone are the days of miscellaneous itemized deductions.
Congress is mean.
Yeah. What about conferences that are for professional development? Heck yeah. Write those off if you have a business. As an individual, you can't. It's personal. So it's always business or personal. Go ahead, Jeff.
The one thing I wanted to add was I couldn't stand it, so I had to look it up. Tuitions is plural, tuition.
Tuitions?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at. It sounded funny.
It's kind of used in a weird way.
But I was thinking of like tuitions for, how'd they put it? For professional learning. Our tuitions for professional learning. So it's plural tuition for something. I would have wanted, I guess, learning, professional learning, whether that could be plural. I don't know. Just struck me as odd. Can a 14-year-old have a business and how to pay taxes? They can be in a business and you would be owning it, more than likely their interest for them until they're 18. But yes, they can be a member of a business and they can work and they can pay taxes just like ordinary people. You could pay them wages out of a business. There's all sorts of stuff.
Is there anywhere, do any states have laws that where a minor can sign contractual agreements?
I don't believe they have capacity until they're 18 or above. Somebody says, can I get a copy of the recording? Yes, we send out the recording. And then somebody says tuitions. The British say it that way, so you know it's correct. You're probably right. I'm like I just looked at it and I was like, is that right? You know what? It's one of those things where now I'll probably start using tuitions. I'll just make sure it's plural all the way around, and then I'll make fun of anybody that tries to correct me.
Just as long as you don't say aluminium.
So that's right. Hey, pop into our YouTube channel, by the way, guys. We're always putting new stuff up. Clint is voracious. You have Tony Talks, Coffee with Carl, my mug sitting here. We're always breaking up these Tax Tuesdays into two or three pieces and sending them out. Jeff just won't stop talking and makes us late every time. Oh, you're still there? Oh, shoot. Maybe it's me. All right, let's jump on. What expenses are you able to write off in your first year of having an LLC? Specifically, expenses associated with establishing your business, Mr. Webb.
So there are two types of expenses you're talking about. There are startup costs, which you hear about a lot, and there are organizational costs. Company goes public, all the costs incurred to getting their stock made public, things like that, filing fees, things of that nature. Those are organizational costs, costs incurred just to get your LLC set up. The startup costs are more along the lines of, I like to say research and development, but that's not really what it is. It's costs that you, expenses you have to explore your company, the possibility of running your company. You're going to incur certain expenses along the way.
So you said organizational expenses?
Organizational expenses, yes.
$5,000. You can absolutely, even if you haven't made a dollar, you can take an organizational expense up to $5,000, right?
Yep.
All right. And then startup is the same, right?
Correct.
And startup is investigation.
Thank you.
And organizational is state, legal, tax, licensing. So think hard costs of setting up, of organizing the business. Startup, you could be investigating a business. Hey, I'm thinking about it. Somebody says, I formed an LLC last year, but I had attended some workshops in 2019 that helped me set up the LLC. Can you write off the cost of the workshop? Yeah, you go back, and the way it works is you're either going to take it as a startup expense if it was like not putting you in a new business, like if it was helping you get investigate and start a business, which a lot of them do. Then you can go up to $5,000 and amortize the rest. Amortizing the rest means 15 years, but it depends on how many of the workshops you went to also. Some people are prepaying for a whole category of things that they're going to do. And they do a little bit and then they take a little break and then they go back and do some more and they take a little break and they're on a progression. And if you incorporate right in the middle of it, some of that's going to be the $5,000 startup and some of that's going to be just ordinary necessary expense that you reimburse. Did I miss state anything, Mr. Webb?
Nope.
Does employee training qualify as a startup expense?
I saw that. That was an interesting question. My first thought was if you have employees, you probably already started your business. Now, I think there might be arguments made that even though you started your business and hired employees, if you really aren't selling anything, say you have a restaurant and you're training people, maybe you haven't really started your business. So it is a startup cost.
Yep. Yeah, so it's kind of weird. Depending on the type of business, you could have a, for example, a building, and you could have 5 years of startup expenses all being basically, you don't get to write it off until you put that building into service, you know? So, mm-hmm. so you're going to just be grabbing those things in year one. You're not writing them off as you go. And then you have the, hey, I started up, this is why we're very bullish on C-Corps, by the way, is we like to have the business set up that's going to manage other businesses because we like those management companies because they're immediately like, hey, starting to manage other businesses. As soon as we have the ability to manage, it could bill, it's a business. And then we're going to grab all those things. And even if they're just a loss carry forward, it's going to offset future income. You're just grabbing them as you go. Somebody says, what about the cost, like supplies, equipment, desks? I'm just reimbursing you those probably as ordinary necessary. I doubt I'm going to grab those as a startup. I'm just going to say, thanks, James, for buying some supplies. If you used up the supplies during the investigation, then that would be a startup.
But 100%.
Yep. So we're always, this is the big, it depends. It's because it's facts and circumstances.
Even going back to any equipment you buy before you actually start your business, we're going to throw that into the business as a capital purchases and depreciate them or bonus them.
I don't have to give it cash. I can give it a bunch of desks, right? And I value that. Let's see. Somebody says, if you haven't answered this already, I live in Maryland. Do you have suggestions on finding a really good CPA with real estate background who can do my taxes? You can reach out to us. We're happy to do them. Or what I always tell people is don't hire people that don't do what you do. So you know how you find a really good CPA that does real estate? Is you go to your local RIA, you go to your investor groups, and you find someone who actually does what you're doing. Or you work with an organization that's all they do. We're, you know, I like to think that we're the best on the planet, but we're not the only game in town, and we're not the best fit for everybody. We lever technology like crazy and all that good stuff. But by all means, you find someone who does what you're doing and you mesh with them, you don't replace them. You buy them nice things in the holidays and you treat them good. And you don't wait till the last minute and then spring stuff on them and then yell at them. You treat them like they're golden because those are the people that are really going to save you some serious stuff. Somebody, like, just so you guys know, there's a Jeff Cohen of Katz and Cohen, Pikesville, Maryland, that somebody threw up. Again, we're all about whatever's in your best interest. So yes, we could absolutely help you, but if you have somebody local, by all means, if that's a better service for you, do that. I heard that you can turn your EIDL loan into a PPP loan and get it forgiven if under $150,000. Is there a procedure to do that? Can you help us with that? Jeff?
I'm going to let you answer this one, Toby.
All right. So EIDL loans, economic injury disaster loans. And it's the way I always explain it is this is the SBA loan that's meant to help you when a tornado hits your place. In this case, we had a national disaster that was declared nationally, and it's called COVID. So all of a sudden, you had square peg and round hole, and the SBA just got hammered. Same time, you had the CARES Act, which created something called a Paycheck Protection Program loan. And that was in March 27th of last year. And the EIDL loans, the EIDLs, I just call them EIDL loans, they're supposed to be up to $2 million, but there's too many people that were asking for them. So they made a max of $150,000. Now, here's where the confusion is. There's two sides to the economic injury disaster loans. There was a emergency grant up to $10,000, and there's a loan up to $2 million that's paid back over 30 years. And then you have the PPP loan, which I forget what they capped it at. I want to say like $5 million or something. It was some huge amount. But if you spent it on payroll and a few other expenses like your mortgage or interest on your, your leasehold, your lease or your mortgage on your facility and perhaps some utilities, then it was forgiven. And so you could get the entire amount forgiven. Well, the EIDL loans allow you to spend things on payroll and utilities and things too. And so what ends up happening is if you have an EIDL loan and you have a PPP loan, you need to use the PPP loan on certain expenses. But your EIDL loan, you could still use on those expenses if you want. It just makes it so that it's not forgivable anymore. And so what you have is this, there's a lot of confusion about it because people are like, well, wait a second. When I get a PPP, if I could use it on anything, yes, you could use it on anything. But if you want it to be forgiven, you have to use it on these things. But I could use the EIDL loan on those exact same things. Well, you want to make sure you're using the EIDL on something else. To the point that a lot of practitioners, including us, they separate the money for the PPP and show it going right into your payroll. Like, we just take all the arguments off the table. We want it to be forgiven, make it easy for everybody, and do it that way. So there's one other side to this where they cross over also, which is the $10,000 maximum emergency grant gets subtracted off your PPP forgiveness. So if you get the grant, let's say that you had $100,000EIDL loan, $10,000 of it is a grant. So there's a $90,000 loan, there's $10,000 free money, and then you go get a PPP loan of $200,000. Well, when you go for forgiveness, that $10,000 grant gets subtracted from the $200,000 PPP loan. So now you have $190,000. I know it gets confusing. Trust me. That's why it's facts and circumstances, and we can simplify it for you. Let's say we can unconfuse it for you, so you know exactly what you're doing. But no, you don't turn an EIDL loan into a PPP loan. They're two very different programs, completely different sections. A PPP loan is a fancy way of saying we're going to give regular banks money to loan to people, and then we're going to pay it for them if they meet certain criteria. So the money came out of your local banker's account, and they're going to get reimbursed from the SBA. The EIDL loan, the money came directly from the SBA. There is no third-party lender involved, and you're going to pay it back. It's an actual loan. Fun stuff. Somebody said, thanks for the private answer. Much appreciated. Oh, that we don't have to do that. Some banks are offering to refund the part that the PPP was reduced by. I don't know what that means. You can always pay back the PPP if you want to call. It's kind of like a refund, I guess. Anyway, it gets... Like if your brain got scrambled a little bit, that's fine. There's some pretty interesting questions going on here. Yes, we do this every other Tuesday, and yes, it's just like this every time. Just in case somebody was wondering. Usually, sometimes we go a little late. Oh, somebody's asking about how to get access, and they want to do a how-to. So, Patty, take a look at Al's comments, so that we can help them use the other resources that are available for free, like a lot of the Facebook and Instagram and all those, and then YouTube and all that. So it looks like there's some folks. All right. Can my S Corp pay me rent for my home office? And if so, is this considered personal income? Mr. Webb.
Can it? Yes, absolutely. Should it? No. And for the very reason you asked in your second question, if you're renting your home office to your S Corp, that's going to be taxable income if it's more than 14 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you really don't want to do that. The better way to do this is you have your home office, you have an administrative office in your home. You're asking your S corporation to reimburse you for the cost of that home office. That is not taxable to you, but is still deductible to that S corp.
Correct. Absolutely. So can you rent your S corp rent a room in the house? Yes, and this becomes investment property. And when you have investment property, it could lease it, and you could do things called depreciation. And once you start depreciation, then it also equals recapture, and then this money right here, the rent, equals income. That's why Jeff says don't do that. Can it? Yes, but you never want to have rent. Instead, what you want to say is home and S Corp, and the S Corp reimburses you. And so what's really going on here, and this is not something under an accountable plan. This is why we like S Corps and C Corps, because we don't have to worry about depreciation recapture. We don't have to file that silly home office deduction form that you do as a sole proprietor. What we're doing here is we're just going to reimburse you the reasonable cost of that space that it's making available to the business. You still have to meet the requirements of saying, hey, it's exclusive use. So let's say that you have a 3-bedroom house, 2-bath, 1 living room, 1 kitchen, and maybe, that's good enough. We'll just call it that. And you take one of the bedrooms and you make it into an office. When you do a reimbursement, and this could be something that's just from a regular employer. It doesn't have to be just your S Corp, but you qualify as an employee of an S Corp. You cannot be an employee of a sole proprietorship that you are the proprietor, or a partnership. You have to be an employee of a business. It would have to be a corporation, either an S Corp, C Corp, LLC taxed as an S Corp, LLC taxed as a C Corp, or 501c3 or 501c26, like any non-for-profit corporation. Then we could sit here and say, all right, we're not going to count the baths, but we're going to count up these rooms, and we have 5 rooms. And so you can reimburse 1/5 of all expenses associated with the house, including mortgage, utilities, if you have a cleaner coming in, all that stuff. Now it could just reimburse you and say thank you. Or you could do net square footage, or you could do gross square footage. You have some choices there. But that S corp could just reimburse you. And then what we look at is reimbursements equals no tax, no withholding, no Social Security, nothing. It's free money. So let's say that Jeff said, Toby, on your way into work, hit Pink Box donuts and bring in a couple dozen donuts. And I bring in some donuts and Jeff hands me some cash and says, the business reimburses you. Can they do that? Or writes me a check, whatever it is. The business can reimburse it. If they have the receipt and they paid for it, then yeah, they can write it off as an expense. What do I do with the cash? I'll tell you what I do with it. I stick it in my pocket. I don't have to report it anywhere. I just got reimbursed. And that's the difference between if I sold the donuts to the business, it could give me $20, but I'd have to recognize that $20 and then I would deduct the cost of the donuts against it. So I could still be in the same place. I could just be at zero, but I'd have to recognize it as opposed to just getting reimbursed for the donuts. Here's what my cost was. I don't have to do any paperwork. I didn't sell anything. I just got reimbursed. Does that make sense? Did I say anything crazy, Jeff?
No, I'm just picturing you going through the company selling donuts. So
I could do that. So 5 + 5 = 10. No, 5 + 5 could equal zero. See, we always have to define what we're using, Brian. See, somebody, a good accountant once told me that. They said, hey, what's 2 + 2? I said, it's 4. And he goes, no, it depends. Two chickens with two wolves go into a room together. 2's coming back out, right? Because the wolves are going to eat the chickens. Some of you guys are slow. You make fun of you. They always think it's the accountant doing something shady. It's like, no, it depends on what it is. So does the answer to the office reimbursement question change if the S-Corp has another office location? Scott, it used to. In 1993, they changed the rule and you can have an administrative office so long as it's where the employee is doing their administrative services, or if it's at the convenience of the employer. So like during COVID, a lot of employees are, you know, the employer wants them to work from home. And so could the employer be reimbursing them? Yeah. Most are saying, hey, you can, which case they're not forced to. So there's a big difference. If I say you cannot ever come into the office ever again, you need to work from house, then I should be reimbursing you for some of your expenses associated. Most employers just pay for all the costs of the items, like a computer and maybe some equipment, keyboard, things like that. But if an employer forces you to work from home and they don't do that, you actually probably have a claim against it. Could they also be reimbursing you for the use of your house? Absolutely, they could. Most aren't, because it's just like, hey, I already provide you with the workplace. We have a lease, right? And they're already paying that expense. But let's just say they said, you know what, Jeff? Everybody's going to work from home. Yeah, I should probably be reimbursing you, or at least covering the cost of your stuff. Anything on there that I say that's crazy, Jeff?
Nope.
And then did you say whether or not this home office reimbursement would have to be done under the accountable plan? Yes, it would be under an accountable plan. In accountable plans, there's a lot of misnomer about it. The accountable plan doesn't even have to be in writing technically, though we recommend it. Accountable plan just basically says the process in which you get reimbursed. So I provide, here's what my expenses are, and then you cut a check. And there's something there that says you're supposed to provide backup when asked so that the employer could basically write it off.
Oh, one thing I wanted to say, Toby, is I know you put down mortgage. They could reimburse you for your mortgage interest, not your mortgage payment.
Yeah, your mortgage payment is, you don't have to, because you're basing it off the value of the property, and you get a portion of depreciation as a recovery. So it kind of sounds weird, but you're being reimbursed for the fact that your house is being used, but it's not tied to the exact mortgage principal. The interest, yes, even if you're paying your interest really fast, if you're paying it, it can reimburse it. And this is where, for those of you who live in states with where the SALT limitation is affecting you, this is how you can get some of that money back in your pocket as a deduction, where, you know, some of you guys are phasing out of your the $10,000 cap, and you're like, shoot, my mortgage, you know, my mortgage interest is $14,000 a year, I'm losing out. Here's a way you can get some of that back in your pocket. Anyway, I think we did good. I always go too long, and now I'm feeling really self-conscious that it's almost 4:30. So let's finish this up. you can always go listen to our podcast. We do put these up as recordings in our podcast too. You can absolutely go through. Some people actually said, thank you for all your knowledge, Jeffrey. Jeff is really smart and Jeff is very measured as opposed to yours truly, who sometimes pontificates. AndersonAdvisors.com podcast. You can go in there. This is what it looks like. You see Jeff. I took his sunglasses off. He was wearing the Men in Black. He was looking pretty good. But you can go in there and also see all the other podcasts that we do. We like to put up there a lot. I just did one with Frank Cottle, which is going to be really, really cool. He's one of the largest virtual office providers in the world, one of the largest in the United States as well. And we had a really good discussion about the future of office space. If you happen to be in office, be on the watch out for it. It went a little long too, but it was really good. Frank's a buddy of mine and he's really, really smart. He knows Dickinson and owns Regis, and they're very good competitors. And they're a lot of fun. He was fun to have on. So he'll be a podcast. There's always really good folks in the podcast. If you want replays of all of these, if you really want to go back and listen to everything we've ever done, we're on 100 and something. I think you can see them in your Platinum portal. And what else? Send your questions in. Again, I grab your out of the questions that are sent in, we send them around to the advisors. A lot of folks just answer them. I have a good chunk of them that get put aside and we pick out of those, usually either the morning of or the night before, and just grab a bunch that sound kind of cool. We just grab them. Somebody says, materially participate, meaning I spend my own money. No. In material participation, there's like 9 different versions, but we'll go over that. You email it in. See, that's a good thing. You can email that in and saying, what is material participation in Airbnb? Talk about it. It's kind of fun. That's it. Jeff, thank you for coming in and hanging out. And thank you for starting the Tax Tuesday 5 minutes early and making us sit around and tap dance.
Thought we might get done 5 minutes early.
Good luck with that. I don't think that will ever happen. Somebody says, thanks, guys. Hey, we really appreciate you coming on. Share it with all your friends. Get people on to Tax Tuesday, especially now in the next few years. This may be more and more critical. I have a feeling we're going to see some action. Anyway, we'll have some fun with that. We'll always make it to where you keep more in your pocket than you have to give away.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.